3 years ago, I was part of a team that made a discovery that shook the world of science, planetary science. This was phosphine on Venus, which I'll unpack later, and is incredibly controversial. But the search for life beyond Earth involves an open mind, involves innovation and taking risks. So let me take you on a journey of exploration. And this journey actually begins billions of years ago, when a simple single-celled bacteria did something very clever. Now, I'm not sure about all of you, but I always think of bacteria as pretty dumb. That's like the mold in your fridge, and you've seen a lot of bacteria. But they did something incredibly clever. They found out how to harness energy from our sun, photosynthesis. And in the process, generated a waste gas, oxygen, which we already heard it today fills our atmosphere to 20% by volume. It's such a reactive gas, it shouldn't be in our atmosphere at all. Without plants and vegetation and photosynthetic bacteria, we would have no oxygen in our atmosphere. We need life to continually replenish it. So if there's an intelligent, we call oxygen a biosignature gas. It's a gas produced by life that can accumulate in our atmosphere to detectable levels. And we're assuming that elsewhere, life uses chemistry like Earth does, like life on Earth does, to extract energy, to store energy and use it, and hopefully generate a waste byproduct gas. And that's what astronomers are doing today. We have found thousands of planets orbiting other stars we call exoplanets. We can study their atmospheres, and we have the capability for the first time ever in human history to search for signs of life on other worlds. Now, there's a lot more to it, and that's what my talk is about today. So just so we're all on the same page, I know we are, but I just always like to start with this. Every star in the sky is a sun. And if our sun has planets, Mercury, Venus, well, we heard all about them, it makes sense that other stars have planets also, and they do. But one of the most amazing things is we haven't yet found a solar system copy. It doesn't mean they're not out there. They're actually very hard to find. But wow, everything is so very different. Now, next time you go out, tonight should be clear, and I know we can see some stars even from the city. So I want you to, after you leave tonight, it might not even be dark though, I forgot, it gets dark so late here. But I want you to, if you're still up, look at the stars and you can wonder, what kind of planet does that star have? Because as far as we can tell, nearly all stars have planets. So many planets. We know of thousands of them now, and there's thousands more that we know about, but we're waiting to confirm them. You know, there are probably billions, trillions of planets in our own galaxy alone. Well, when I look at the stars, what I like to imagine is that there's an intelligent alien civilization on a planet orbiting a nearby star with the kind of telescopes we're hoping to build. And they're looking back at Earth, and they see oxygen. And they suspect that that means there might be life here, because it has to be continually produced. So the takeaway is they won't initially be able to see things like the Great Wall of China or city lights or pollution, but it's by oxygen, a gas that doesn't belong, that's very reactive, that must be continually produced. So people are nodding, but at least one person disagrees, our Professor Schultz-Melk. But it turns out that what the aliens are probably doing, if they found oxygen on our planet, they're probably fighting about it. The data analysis, the attribution, and things like that. So it's not as straightforward as it sounds. So one of the big new things in our field is our brand new space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope. I'm guessing like at least half of you watched the launch in 2021 on Christmas morning. This telescope has been 30 years in the making, and there's a small picture, artist conception in the middle. And what's special about the James Webb Space Telescope are three things. One is its size. You can see that on the far right, compared to the Hubble Space Telescope, it has 7 times more collecting area, so it can see fainter things. On the far left, it's just explaining that this telescope is orbiting 1 million miles away from Earth. Earth is hot and bright and bad for astronomy. We want to be far from Earth. And at the bottom, it's showing you that it operates at infrared wavelengths, which is really nice for looking for gases, because many of them, they rotate and molecules rotate and vibrate and interact with light at infrared wavelengths. So this telescope is so crazy. If you look at it, it doesn't look like a telescope. It has a mirror, but it doesn't have a cover because it's so big. So instead of the cover, the engineers designed a very special tennis court-sized sunshield. It's made of many layers. They all have a different woven pattern. So when radiation hits one, it gets put in all directions. It's not just passing it through from layer to layer. That not only blocks light, but also heat from the sun. I only picked this one example to show you, but there were 12 other brand new technologies that had to be invented for the James Webb Space Telescope. So if you want to know more about this telescope, I encourage you to watch this documentary called The Hunt for Planet B. And Nathaniel Kahn made this film to share with you the technology journey, but he also follows a number of people around to capture the why. And the why is because we all wonder, where did we come from? You know, where are we going? How did our own Earth form and our solar system come to be? Are we alone? I was one of those people who was in the film, and so we got invited when this film was nominated for an Emmy Award. We got invited to go to New York City for the award ceremony, because you don't know who's going to be chosen. So we go there and to support our friend Nathaniel, and we get there early, and there's like hardly anyone there, but it turns out the well-dressed famous people, they arrive later in the evening. Then they file us all into this auditorium that's like glowing blue and purple, and there's like a comedian being the announcer. And it's kind of like a high school or college graduation. You're waiting forever for your or your people's turn. So we're all sitting together, waiting, waiting, waiting. Finally, our category is called. There's 5 films per category. And they do a 1-minute clip before they announce the winner. And nobody knows, not even the announcer. And we won an Emmy. There's us with our words. So I encourage you to watch this film to find out all about how it came to be, how the telescope came to be. So what are we going to do with the telescope? Well, myself and it's literally like 1,000 other people probably around the globe are using the telescope to study exoplanet atmospheres. And now I'm going to walk you through how we do that. What you see on the top figure is an artist's conception of a planet going in front of the star as seen from the telescope. See the star is this yellow sun-like star, and there's a planet, and you can see this light gray area is the atmosphere. This is all exaggerated for you. We don't spatially resolve any stars like this other than our sun. But the bottom shows you what we see. It's real data. And this is with the James Webb Space Telescope, but we see worse data, more noisy data, with a lot of other telescopes. What you're seeing here is when the planet is, you're seeing the relative brightness of the star as a function of time. And this, it's hard for us to see the units, but this is about 3-hour duration. And the star is just doing its own thing. It's shining brightly, the same brightness with time. When, if we're lucky and a planet goes in front of the starlight drops by a very characteristic pattern. And the depth there, that's related to the planet area to the star area. Remember pi r squared, size, area of the planet compared to the area of the star. So for a hot Jupiter, a Jupiter-sized planet, it's about 1%. And we can measure that brightness easily from ground-based telescopes. So are you all with me on that? Because that's key. The planet goes in. Not all planets go in front of the star. If the planet's orbiting in the plane of the sky, it will never go in front. We require like a fortuitous alignment. There's thousands of transiting planets. For a lot of technical reasons I don't have time to get into, it's the most popular way today that we find planets. So what we're here to talk about is atmospheres. And what I want you to look at now is the top artist conception. Do you see the solid part of the planet is a certain size, but the atmosphere makes the planet look bigger? It turns out, though, that at certain wavelengths, the planet will be highly absorbing. And then the planet will be big. It will be a different size because it's the planet plus the atmosphere. At other wavelengths, the planet atmosphere will be transparent. We'll be able to see right through. Then the size is much smaller. So what we're in fact looking for is the change in size of a planet as a function of wavelength. Now you get to have a little test. So what you're seeing here is the relative brightness as a function of time. That's an awkward unit in days, but don't worry about that. The different colors and the indicator in the top right are showing you the different wavelengths, so it has W. The black is the average, it looks like the average data. I want to say it might be a best fit model, but it kind of looks like the average data. Now your job is to look at what wavelength is the transit deeper than the black line. So what you're going to see is all those little points, right? They're going to drop when the planet looks a tiny bit. Because remember, the atmosphere at certain wavelengths, the atmosphere looks bigger. You can just nod because if you see it. Normally in the audience, I would ask you, like, shout out the number. Did y'all see it? That's okay. We need to just step back for a moment and think about how amazing this is. We live in a time when by eye, each and every one of you can see evidence for a planet atmosphere because the planet is getting a tiny bit bigger. And what is enabling all this is the James Webb Space Telescope with its exquisite precision. And that is why I want to say that's why I'm here today, but I'm really happy that I'm here right now because this telescope is brand new and the best is yet to come. So now I'm going to show you our more scientific representation of what you saw. And what you're seeing here now is the amount of light blocked in percent as a function of wavelength. So we're not talking about time anymore. Now it's all stuck together. So the planet itself blocks out about 2%, let's say 2.1% of the light. But when you have an atmosphere, it's going to about 2.25%. So what you're seeing here are the white with the error bars is real data from the James Webb Space Telescope, and the blue is a model. It's a best fit model. And what you're supposed to do here is agree with me that these white points that are real data are different from a straight line. Because if it was a straight line, we wouldn't be seeing signs that the planet's getting a little bit bigger with wavelength. And this part of the spectrum, it's due to the molecule carbon dioxide. So now, hopefully, that's kind of like a tutorial part of the talk. You can all go away and say, you know how we can measure planet atmosphere. We've seen carbon dioxide in this giant planet atmosphere. And I have a little more of a scientific present. You don't have to understand this to understand the rest, but I wanted to put this out here for the people who wanted a little more detail. So there's a lot of gases it could be, but it turns out that only carbon dioxide fits this. And this is a hot, giant planet. It's not a rocky world that might have life. It's too hot for life. It has no surface as we know it. So that's where it is. So there's a lot of new other atmosphere things. I'm not going to talk about them today, but for example, one group studied a so-called mini Neptune and sees sign of water vapor in the atmosphere, but isn't sure if it's from the star spot or from that. Other people have studied a planet and found its atmosphere is very shiny. It's very reflective. But what's really interesting here is that there's probably six people in this audience who have new data from the James Webb Space Telescope that aren't telling us yet what exciting thing they've found. So in fact, even though I could summarize a lot of the news, I don't even know the latest because everyone's busy working to get the results. I also wanted to dial us back to the last year of the last millennium, 1999. I was a newly minted PhD, and I was starting my new job at the Institute for Advanced Study. Now, if you ever have to worry about how to make small talk with scientists, the thing you can do, this is what everyone did when I arrived at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, they asked me, what's the next big thing? So that's the easy thing you can do. Well, at the time, we had about 30 exoplanets, right, compared to the thousands and thousands today. We had no transiting planets. Remember, I told you how the planet's going in front of the star. It's the most easy way we find them today. And my answer to what's the next big thing? Transiting planet. We were overdue. It was time for one to be discovered. That's why I had started working on the transit transmission spectra. And that very fall, the first transiting planet was announced. I rushed to finish my paper, and I was the one who got to invent this whole method. So not only that, but shortly after, another team took the idea and applied to use the Hubble Space Telescope, and very soon after found the first atmosphere ever. I'm telling you this because I want you to know there was a time when people didn't believe we would find very many planets. They didn't believe we would study their atmospheres. There I was at the Institute, a very respected place, by the way, trying to get a permanent job, and was rejected pretty much everywhere. Because people said, wow, this is a one-object, one-method success story, meaning the first atmosphere discovered with this method, right? One time, I went to a very highly top US university interviewing for my job, all super prepared. I sat down with this older, supposedly wiser professor. He just went, oh, we'll never have very many transiting planets. Well, we have thousands of them now, right? I'm just trying to paint this picture for you that in the search for life beyond Earth, there's a line between what is mainstream research and what is crazy. And that line is constantly shifting. Right? So when we were talking about the meteorite from Mars, and I loved your talk and how you said maybe there is actually life there, we don't know. What the meteorite from Mars did was it shifted that line. So all this out there work is actually very important. So back to exoplanets. Here's an image of our Earth and Sun. Not Earth and Sun. That is a real image of our Sun. You can see sunspots, and you can also see, hopefully, my fake planet there, the little solid black dot. Our Earth is tiny compared to our Sun. I wrote some numbers for the people who are, you know, like numbers. Our Earth is 10,000 times smaller than our Sun in area. Our atmosphere of our Earth is tiny. It's like the skin of an onion on an onion. So we can't observe atmospheres with the transit transmission spectrum technique right now. We just can't do it because that atmosphere signal compared to the whole star is just too small. And I put a number for you, it's just approximate. The atmosphere to star ratio is one part in a million. We can't do that with the Webb telescope. So what we can do is we can study small planets transiting small stars. And that's like a happy thing for us because there's lots of small stars out there. They're the most common type of star in our galaxy are these small red dwarf stars. And now I've put that same fake planet, it literally was cut and paste. And you can see it on the red star, it takes out a big area. Now the signal is one part in 100, and the atmosphere is about one part in 10,000. Actually, I'm part of a team that's going, in July, we have observations of TRAPPIST-1E coming up. So all we're doing now is, that's kind of a big push in the search for life, because it's all we can do for exoplanets. Small planets, small stars. So let me take you on a virtual trip to a small planet orbiting a small star, just so I can get your head around like what it, I mean, we don't know what it's like. We're just using our imagination. But we do have some facts. For one thing, some of these stars, this is an artist's conception, so the artist sometimes takes it a bit far. They've made the atmosphere like a different, the sky a different color. They've made the sun very big. But these planets orbiting small stars, they're very close to the star. Well, not all of them, but if they want to be, if for a planet that's the right temperature for life as heated by the star, the planet has to be quite close to the star. It's like the campfire analogy. You have to be very close to a small fire, very close. It's so close that the star, in some cases, might be big in the sky. But the planets that are so close to the star, over time, due to tides, just like we have our ocean tides, there's tides on the planet from the star, and eventually, over, I think, tens of millions of years, the planet goes into a special low-energy state called tidally locked. The planet rotates one time for every time it orbits. And it shows so the same face to the star at all time. Our moon does that with Earth. You always see the same face of the moon. That means its day is equal to its year. So what this means if we could visit the planet is that the sun or that star, the sun to us, is always in the same place at all times. So you could choose to visit. Where would you go? Would you go where it's always day? Or would you go where it's always night? Well, here it's always, we would want to do night for an astronomy gathering. Or you could literally go where the sun is always setting. It's not strictly two because the planet's going to librate a bit, so, but on the whole, that's right. Also, what's really interesting is the planets are so close to the star by Kepler's third law, the orbit is, you know, if you're that close to the star, 1 year, one time around, it takes about 10 days or even less. So 1 year would be about 10 days. And that would be the length of the day as well. So when I think about this planet on second thought, it might be a bad idea to visit because the stars, these M dwarf stars, they give off a lot of high energy radiation. They have flares. We couldn't be glued to our phones because the high energy particles would knock out the electronics. So it actually might not be a place. And I wanted to just spend a few minutes talking about this because it ends up not just being a story, but being a kind of serious impediment to our search for life. Now, it turns out that our sun also gives off flares. Here's an image from a satellite. It's at a very narrow wavelength, so that's why it looks all modeled like that. But I want to take us to, now again back in time, but this time to the late, I want to say 1840s, 1850s, when we had a very special event on Earth called the Carrington Event. At this time, an amateur astronomer, British astronomer named Carrington was studying our sunspots, and he noticed some brighten, some of the spots brightened. And a day and a half later, our Earth became electrified. Here, we could see the northern lights all the way almost down to the equator. These latitudes, we could go outside and read a book by the northern lights. We're so bright for two whole days. This was an incredible time. We didn't have electricity back then, but we had telegraph wires. Those wires caught fire. The telegraph operators could take out the batteries and it still worked. Now, no one died during this event, but it turns out here on Earth, we're kind of overdue for the next one, actually. You heard it here. It's kind of a bad thing, at least in the United States. It would be really a pandemic of a different kind, actually, because our whole power grid isn't prepared for this level of activity. So why am I telling you this? Well, it turns out that these M dwarf stars give off a lot of flares. And our favorite system, TRAPPIST-1, it was observed with the Kepler Space Telescope over 80 days, and it had 40 flares. I'd actually like to give a shout out to Max Gunther, who works at ESA, who led a study using the test data to just show how often and how strong all these flares are. This TRAPPIST-1 star appears to have given off one Carrington-level event of a flare within that 80-day period. So why is this a problem? The reason is pretty serious for us right now, that when we want to study the atmospheres, the tiny, tiny signal, that drop in brightness, at the moment, we actually can't do that for these small planets transiting small stars because the stars are active. They're not just giving off the flares, but they're active with spots. These star spots are evolving, the star is rotating, and so instead of having like a uniform background we can subtract, our background is changing. And this right now is a big problem. So just take away, these M-dwarf stars are very active compared to our star. That means a lot of different things. They've got magnetic fields that are causing this problem. And here's some technical terms. The surface inhomogeneities result in the star. Remember we talked about the change in size as a function of wavelength. The star is creating trouble for us because of star spots and other things. And this is a problem that I and many others are working on right now, because we need to solve this problem if we're going to be able to search for the tiny, tiny, tiny signals that might indicate there's life on the planet. So it seems like we know what we're doing, other than that problem I just mentioned. We know that there are rocky exoplanets in the so-called habitable zone of their host star. They're planets that are rocky, they have surface, they're the right temperature for life. We have a method to study atmospheres of exoplanets. By the way, we also have a list of biosignature gases. It's not just oxygen, but essentially we're looking for a gas that doesn't belong in context with its environment. And this would be, we have many ideas, methane, nitrous oxide. I mean, many of them have complications too. They may have sources that are well-known sources that are not life. I could list, there's literally thousands of gases, all right? And again, the mold, not all of you have this, but you know, you get home, the mold in your fridge smells bad. That's a biosignature gas. The pine forest, those are biosignature gases. We have a lot of options. So it sounds like we have a plan. But I have to confess that it's going to be way harder than we ever expected, actually. And now I'm gonna digress from exoplanets for a moment to talk a bit about phosphine. So I've been working on a list of all the possible gases that might be a sign of life. And our favorite gas from this search is the gas phosphine. It's a phosphorus atom with three hydrogen atoms. On Earth, like most of you have not heard of phosphine because it's not a thing, it's not around. We don't have phosphine just sort of here on Earth. It's highly thermodynamically disfavored. Our phosphorus wants to go with oxygen, not with hydrogen. In fact, it's only us humans, we make phosphine as a pesticide. Life in oxygen-free environments, like in wetlands, in animal guts, that also makes phosphine. People have measured phosphine in the lab from bacteria. So I was working on this, and oddly enough, an astronomer across the globe, Professor Jane Greaves, was also working on phosphine as a biosignature gas, and she was purposely searching for it on, remember the phrase, the line between crazy and mainstream is constantly shifting. This was definitely on the crazy side, looking for signs of life on Venus. And someone connected our two teams, and she invited my team to help her write proposals and interpret the data. And so probably half of you remember 2.5 years ago, we made an announcement on the detection of phosphine gas on Venus. We weren't claiming we found life, but just like with here on Earth, where we have very little hydrogen, the temperatures and pressures don't favor phosphine, we wrote 100 pages explaining why it couldn't be made by at least known chemistry. There's always room for some unknown chemistry. And what happened was this result became immediately controversial. People were angry, our friends and colleagues. That's like maybe for the next, you know, another symposium, the sociology of human nature. this is really important for me just to briefly recapitulate that some people reanalyzed our data and did not find the signal. And this is a tiny signal in very, very noisy data. Other people did recover the signal, but wanted to say it's not phosphine, it's another gas, sulfur dioxide. The people who would agree, maybe or were maybe agnostic, that it is phosphine, wanted to give it a chemistry, you know, have a chemical explanation that's not life. So at every level, it's been controversial. Is the signal real? Is the signal put to the right gas? Is it life? So I stand by my team. We're always writing papers. We have one that just came out with some people who said the chemistry was wrong. They ended up agreeing with us due to a thermodynamic error in a database. But the team's spending a lot of time like refuting each one. So that's where we are there. But why is it so crazy? Because Venus, we heard already, it's a crazy place for life. The surface is far too hot. It's hot enough to melt lead. But in Venus, just like on Earth, when you go high up above the surface, it's you know how here it gets colder and colder? If you hike a mountain or go on a plane, it gets colder and colder. So too on Venus. It's just the right temperature for life in the clouds. We have life in our clouds. Bacteria float up and get there. And so that sounds promising. But it turns out the clouds are actually made of sulfuric acid, not water. And any chemists in the room, sulfuric acid is incredibly dangerous. You put it, if it falls on your clothes, it burns a hole. It will damage your skin very badly. And I just want to capture this for you for a second, because it's during that pandemic summer, there were no jobs for teenagers, no sports. The police had taken the basketball nets down. The football, the soccer fields were closed. And we put our 17-year-old son to work on Venus, mostly on like internet searches for engineering. He got that done quickly, and he pushed to do real experiments. So we set up an outdoor lab, and it turns out you can't order large amounts of sulfuric acid to your home. You knew that already. But you can order a lot of little bottles. So we ordered a lot of little bottles. Now I want you to dial back now for yourselves when you were 17 and imagine you have a very dangerous chemical, an outdoor laboratory, and you're going to explore what things around you may or may not survive. What's the first thing you're going to put in sulfuric acid? Outdoors in the summer. Well, before I could say, please don't do that, he put an ant in sulfuric acid. It had a seizure and turned to goo before you could blink, basically. So that might help you understand why people think Venus is a terrible place for life. And so if you're a journalist in the room, I know you're going to want to ask me about phosphine on Venus. Please don't ask me about phosphine on Venus. But I actually do have something more interesting for you. And I'm not here to talk about the solar system, but I just can't resist sharing this with you. So the reason our ant didn't survive, one of the main reasons, is that our DNA can't survive in sulfuric acid. We have a sugar phosphate backbone. Does not survive. But what my team has started to do recently in the laboratory is use sulfuric acid and put complicated biomolecules in sulfuric acid and see if they survive. And it turns out many of them actually do. And we have a result coming out next week. It says embargoed until the week of June 12th. And it's too complicated for me to go through this slide, but part of our DNA, our nucleic acid bases, the ladder, ACGT, adenine, cytosine, et cetera, we put those in sulfuric acid, waited like days to weeks, and found it's all stable, almost too stable. It gets protonated, but it is very, very stable. And I wish I could tell you more about this whole field, but there's a giant paradigm shift happening now. And this line between crazy mainstream, it's moving very slowly. It's probably going to be 10 years from now when you finally hear that this is, wow, legit. But there are many different things going on. I can't tell you all about it because I don't have time. But I want you to know that this is probably, exoplanets is big, but this idea that there could be life in sulfuric acid using sulfuric acid as a solvent, not water, it's becoming, honestly, like more real to me every day. And there's a lot more behind what I just said, but you're going to hear the first of it next week with these new results. So what are we going to do about all of this? We already heard we're going back to Venus. I'm leading an international consortium we call Morningstar Missions to Venus, and we have our first ever largely privately funded mission launching in January 2025. We have a single instrument. We're going to fall through the clouds and spend 5 minutes in the clouds, send our limited amount of data home, and we're looking for fluorescence and backscattered polarized radiation to indicate the presence of sulfuric acid. Well, we have a lot of solar system objects, but they're finite in number. We have so many stars. We have a great, we still want to be able to find signs of life. And for the last part of my talk, I'm just going to, finish off with one new way we have in the future to find planets and signs of life. Because transits are only the first part of a long story, the object has to be very specially aligned or it's not going to transit. And we miss most planets, by the way, because most of them are not transiting. They're aligned in a different way. Furthermore, I told you all about the M-dwarf stars. We're doing what we can, but we may have a problem. They may not have atmospheres because of all the activity of the star. I don't want to say we're not going to solve the hard problem of stellar variability. We're all, the best and brightest, are trying to solve this. Nonetheless, we want to try to find the Earth twin. There's no question we want the other Earth around the Sun. How to find an Earth-Sun twin? We want to send a giant screen in space attached to a spacecraft and block out the starlight so we can see another planet directly. And we do have a way to do that, But first, we can't put up a giant circular screen, because if we try to block out a point of light with a circular screen, we get ripples shown on the top right. Just like dropping a pebble into a pond, you get ripples. Light acts like a wave, and it bends around the outside edges of a giant screen. So even the star's a point of light, we would get these light ripples that are 100,000 times brighter than the planet we're looking for. So instead, we have to put up a very special shape. It would be like dropping a pebble in the pond when the pond would be perfectly smooth and all the waves put to the outside edges. So I just want to tell you a tiny bit about this mission. It's not a funded mission, but the Starshade could launch with a telescope. These petals would unfurl from their stowed position, and the central truss would expand, snapping those petals into place. This Starshade is tens of meters in diameter, and it would have to formation fly tens of thousands of kilometers from its telescope and get lined up just so it could block out the starlight, and we have a chance of finding another Earth directly. And this is one of my main interests. It's one of the main things I work on, and I'm partly telling you about this for my astronomy colleagues in the room who may not be in the know of like everything that's going on in the U.S. Starshade has been a bit on the back burner, but we're still working hard. Here's some real pictures from the lab about Starshade. And I'm going to close in a moment. I know I'm giving you a very complicated slide. I just wanted to show this to my astronomy colleagues. The bottom, this is planet-star contrast. We have to block out the starlight to immense numbers of decimal places. The bottom is the angular separation of the star and the sky. We have all these different curves. Starshade is the bottom yellow one, orders of magnitude better than any other way we have right now, at least in the lab, to block out starlight. So let me summarize for you. We know of thousands of planets orbiting nearby stars. I've convinced you we can observe exoplanet atmospheres, and we're on our way to doing this for small rocky worlds with our brand new James Webb Space Telescope. This is limited to transiting planets and small stars. So the point is that our first capability ever in human history is with the James Webb Space Telescope, and we're doing all we can to make sure that we can observe small rocky planet atmospheres and search for signs of life. I want to leave you with this idea that it's a generations-long search. We're just here at the beginning now. And let me wish you clear thoughts, clear skies, and your own special journey of exploration. Thank you.